The Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies presents the Pearl of Great Price Lecture Series, given by Dr. Hugh Nibley. Today's lecture is entitled The Council.
The impact of the Memphite theology was so fundamental that its effect on the Egyptian religious thought remained constant until the end of Egyptian religion. This was the dominant text. If there was a Bible, this would be it. This was their Genesis. This was their Torah. Unparalleled in the history of the ancient Orient as far as its cosmogenic significance is concerned, it deals not only with the creation, but it deals with the cosmogony. And of course, this is our Pearl of Great Price, especially the book of Abraham and Moses. They're both very strong in cosmogony, as you know, Moses being a re-editing of Abraham, which we'll see later. It's cosmogonic. That's not cosmological explanation of the cosmos, but cosmogonic, how the cosmos came to be. So, significance is concerned. It traveled from century to century, from one theological system to another. Its theme sounds from the first line of Genesis. We have it in our Genesis, Bereshit, Bara Adonai, and so forth. From here on, Bereshit talks of Joseph had it right, too, because he said it was the council that met at the beginning. That's what we're talking about, the council here. From the first line of Genesis, from there on through the Old Testament and the latest period of Hebrew literature, it reaches the pages of the New Testament, witnessing to what extent this conception of creative power of the Word of God persisted in the ancient Orient, becoming a universal theological theme, goes right on down into the New Testament. Just while the Memphite theology through the Old Testament prepared the consciousness of the religious world for John's Logos, the doctrine of John, we'll see, Logos doctrine about the manifestation and creative power of the Word of God, so the Amarna theology sounded some themes which in the New Testament, especially in John's Gospel, represent fundamental features of the relationship between the Father and the Son. Now all this is in the Shabako text. Remember we said it was Shabako king, Shabako being the third king of the 25th dynasty. And after Kashta, then comes Pianki, and then Shabako's his younger brother. His name means wildcat. It's funny, this dynasty, their names very often refer to cats of various sorts. Shabako, and this was in the 25th dynasty. He began to reign about 716, as usual. The usual, none of that comes very late, but remember, when he wanted to celebrate the establishment, to legitimize the dynasty, he decided to go through all the ordinances, renew the temple of the white wall, and which was the center, the oldest temple, which is where the Egyptian kingdom was founded. You know how the delta goes here, goes up the coast here, and then the delta comes down here like this, and then you go like that. And here was Memphis, right at the base. See, this is at the base of the delta where you get Cairo. And here we're going to have the Red Sea come down here. There, that's all right. And this is the peninsula, the Sinai Peninsula. It goes up a little farther. Carries right on up, you know, into the Jaffa and the Negev, and here's the Dead Sea up here. But this is where it all centered here. And he's going to where the two lands were united, the North Land and the South Land. It's a very interesting account, you know, how after the serpents were driven from the land, it tells us how the serpents were driven out. And great heaps of them were piled up and set afire. The only way they could get rid of it, they were a health hazard. The foul stench of these piles of serpents. Remember, it was swamp country, and it was to occupy, and it had to overcome these serpents all the time. Now, Eloise Baumgartel, who made the main study on this particular subject, she says, in the earliest time, they preserved all the land northward, all this land up here, as a refuge for game and for cattle grazing. It was not farmed. It was practically not populated. She's wrong there, but she gives us a picture with various documents as to how they spared one part of the land for farming. This was where the very rich Nile Valley, and the other part was for game, for hunting. This is where they loved to hunt. Their hunting was in the marshes, remember. They didn't hunt in the back country. The king, kings of the 18th dynasty and so forth went into Asia, hunted lions and elephants, loved that sort of thing. But all the great hunting through the early dynasties was done in the marshlands. And remember in the book of Ether, King Lib did the same sort of thing. After he had driven out the serpents, Remember, it rained and the serpents went away. Then he divided the land into two parts. He kept the land south as a refuge for game, and he kept all the land northward as a land under cultivation. That was this populated country. He used the same system here that was used in pre-dynastic times in Egypt to save it. But this is what Shabaka wants to revive now. He's going to have the center here, which is called the balance of the land, the Mehat Tawi, the balance of the two lands, and it's written with a balance because the two are going to be equal. This is a very important theme in this document here. The Anonis Klaus Koch, very recently writing, says, the only priestly mythological text in Egypt, there's only four of them, two are not very important. The two are the most important by far is this one, and the other one is the other version called the Victory Over Seth, which I have a complete copy of, and which is very good too. This was an ordinance that had to be performed in all the temples, in every temple, every day. And it's just this one. It's just this same story. This lasts, I say, right down through to the end of Egyptian religion, taken up by, well, the Hermetics, taken to Europe and so forth, Italy, with the mysteries, and also in the Old Testament and the New Testament. I was going to... I was supposed to have a couple of slides ready to present this today. It might help to see the characters and so forth and explain what's what here. But they were supposed to have them last Friday, but they were lost, and that's the second time they've been lost, and they should be ready this week. So next time I may be able to expose you to these. This is, as I showed you, what it looks like. This one is too faint, and this one, they reduced in size in order to get it onto one piece. But this was recopied. Well, he tells us how it was done, you see. This is, in the top, there's a, going to take either half like this. In the top, there's an inscription telling us what king this is and how it was found and under what circumstances it comes down to us. And you notice whenever his name Shabaka is mentioned, somebody has scrubbed it out. Every time another dynasty, because remember this was a Nubian dynasty, they came up there and they were succeeded by the 26th dynasty, which is the brilliant revival, you see, the 26th dynasty. That was Semeticus and Necho. This is the time of the Book of Mormon, the next dynasty is the time of the Book of Mormon. But it's interesting, the Book of Mormon proper names all come from this dynasty, which was much more favorable to Israel. It's an interesting thing. And there's some village in the Book of Mormon. I mean, it couldn't possibly have been invented, it came out of this dynasty. Well, so it begins. Oh, well, at the beginning, do we need to mention what it was? Yes. Sepeter, Hemeth. His Majesty had this copied in stone. See, he found it. His Majesty had this copy, Sepeter. I see we had the sign here. We'd show you why it meant that. It means come back and repeat and write over again. It's really quite graphic. This is written phonetically, but never, never without a determinant to show what we're talking about, the general idea. Makes it possible to guess. Without that, you'd really be at a loss. His Majesty commanded this writing to be copied anew in the house of his father Ptah. Now Ptah is the god of Memphis. That's where this is, Memphis. And Memphis is on this side of the river. When you just go right across to this side, Cairo's here, Memphis is here, and right across the river is, you can see the pyramid of Zoser there at Saqqara. So everything gathers together there. But he found it in the father house of his father, Ptah. Now we see that Ptah is very important here. We can see a lot of him. Which one is he? In the house of his father, Ptah. And who is the Lord south of the wall? That expression, south of the wall. Because they were divided into two parts. And around the circuit of the walls, the southern part belonged to his temple and belonged to him. The white kingdom, the older kingdom, was the southern one. The northern kingdom, the red kingdom, was the other kingdom. And this dividing is a very important thing. You get it very interestingly in the romantics, in the patriarchal romances of the Old Testament. Comes out all over the place. You're going to find mention of that here. Namely, the reference to these megalithic centers. This was an old megalithic center way back here. See, Heliopolis is right near here. That's just the airport right up here. They're all together here at the airports today, just north of Cairo. In fact, it's a suburb of Cairo. And there, Mariette found it long ago. It's been destroyed. They took all the rocks to use ballast for railroad tracks. And the British came in, so all that went. But it was a tremendous megalithic foundation. I mean, a circle of 365 stones. It was one of those centers which you find all over the world. We mentioned the last time Professor Tom, who's correlated these things. Even Professor Edwards has come around to realizing the significance of that. Well, but it tells us in the House of the Wall, yeah. Whose house is the one south of the wall? When His Majesty found it, herein, as it had been produced by the ancestors in the earliest period. The Tepau, the people who came at the very first, at the very beginning of everything, the first ancestors. So it was ancient when it was written, you see, originally, and it was written for this to celebrate the founding of Egypt, the first dynasty by Menes. Remember, Menes, the first king, he founds the dynasty to celebrate it. He builds this temple, and then in this temple, he justifies, the whole purpose of this, you see, is to justify the legitimacy of the king's rule on earth. Does he have God's approval? Has he right to rule, and so forth? How does it come that God set up his rule on earth? This is dramatized. First, they have to go with the creation, the council in heaven, the creation, Satan's rebellion and so forth, the fall, and then the plan that is given, the plan of salvation. It's all set forth there quite clearly. This is why I say it's remained the basic document. So we have the Menes. You've got to put Menes here. Mene. Is that the same as Narmer of the pre-dynastic palette? Some people think it was. Some people, even H.R. Hall, thought this was the same as Minos, the Minos of because it was a sea empire as well, the Minos of Crete, the Minotaur was his pet, see, just as the Apis bull was his pet. Anyway, it goes on here. When he found it, he found that lo and behold, it had belonged. It was the record of the ancestors. You think of Lehi looking at the brass plates and discovering they went back to the beginning, quite thrilled by it. See, and then unfortunately it had been eaten by worms, by Finnish here, so that it could not be read in the beginning parts and in the ending parts, from the beginning to the end. Then we have a blank here, because I say a column stood on here for thousands of years, and so that blotted out the middle part, but we do have the beginning and the conclusion here, which I guess is the most important anyway. As I say, if a play has a good beginning and a good end, you can forget about the middle. That's what happens here. Though the middle is very interesting. It's the Garden of Eden story, very obviously, but we start out with the others. Well, then His Majesty had it copied anew, more fair than it was in the first place. Are you here? Yes. More beautiful than it was in the first place. And Mayor, for the purpose that it should not pass away again, he had it done on hard stone and so forth. But the main purpose is that his name should endure. It's very important to have your name should endure, not only the king's, but everybody's. See, the Egyptians are very different, you see, from the Orientals here. You don't go into a great sea of being after this. You don't wish to be non-identified. You don't wish to be absorbed into the nothing karma. The Egyptian is always dead set on preserving his individuality. Say, I have some statements by Brigham Young on that are rather interesting. Did I include them here? They might be in here. He says, he gives the Egyptian point of view very, very well here. Yeah, here it is. He says some things like this. No. He's talking about another creation story. That talks about Adam in very much the same way. Well, this will be relevant when we get to it. This is Brigham talking about other worlds, which is a favorite subject of his. Well, he goes on here, and hey, we have to get things in order here. I took a lot of notes. Why not use them? That his name might endure. But you wanted that for your name, not just the king's name, but every man. Very early, the king had these rights. It was the king's secret. The secret of immortality, the ordinances of the temple. He received all the ordinances and the endowment, and that would make him a king and a priest forever. That was the idea. But very early, members of the royal family got let in onto this secret, and they too have the same rights, ordinances, even the same insignia that the king has. And finally, I say before very long, already in the Middle Kingdom, everybody has it. Any man can claim all the rights of royalty and be a king and a priest forever in his tomb if he pays attention to the proper ordinances. So he says that his name might endure and that his Siwa Enef, and that it might, that his monument might be established, so I mean built, established, that his monument might be fairly established in the house of his father at the south side of the wall for out the length of time and eternity. E Yao Jed M. And then so, regard well, then it's blanked out, the son of the son, that he might remember his father. And here's good old Ta again. But this is, well, this is his name to whom life is given forever. See, they've rubbed it out here, so you can't read very well, to say the least. So he starts out. Now, it's arranged like a play, and it's arranged quite graphically. It's set forth on this in this inscription, of course, in the rock this way. And it starts out with two lines, giving the setting, giving the time, the place, the persona, the dramatis persona, and so forth. Ta Penpel, this is Ta, whom you see sitting here. Ma'at M. Ren Ta Chenin, who is being acclaimed, who is acclaimed in his name of Ta Chenin. Ta Chenin. So this is Ta being acclaimed as Ta Chenin. Now as to Ta, first as to the beginning in general. Since he went to the trouble to look up in Bonnet, we might as well tell you what he says to say about it. Well, not only that. But he says the Egyptians do not, well, see, in Bonnet, it's the big lexicon in which he collects all the information on the subject, Hans Bonnet, if you want to know where to go for it. Well, of course, now there's a bigger one now, the new lexicon of Egyptology, which is many volumes, is still coming out. But the beginning of the world, beginning of the universe, the Egyptians do not attempt to explain the first ultimate beginning. But they begin with a given quantity. Die Welt in ihrer materiellen Sein als ein gegebenes. The universe, the material of the universe, is a given quantity to begin with. They don't argue about what must come before that, because it's a waste of time, among other things. It's imponderable. Should we be here? The idea, of course, this idea, of course, of ontology. Should we exist at all? Is it right? Well, we could argue about that till the cows come home. But why bother? We are here, you see. As we used to say to the little kids when we went somewhere, you should have thought of that before you left home. It's too late now, you know. It's too late now, we're here already. Let's begin with that as a given quantity. That's the thing that Professor Wormut up at the U of U was very much impressed by. He was one of their most eminent professors up there. He died recently, unfortunately, but they got him, considered themselves very lucky to have Professor Wormut. And just the thing about Mormonism, it is the only non-speculative religion. Every other religion just speculates and speculates on the beginning of things and should we be here and so forth. But we take in certain things as given, that we are here and the world is here and we don't bother about, we go on from there. Well, they go on from there too, he says here. Now the process, therefore, the lauf of creation is therefore one, since they accept the material is there already, of organization. Beginning with matter unorganized. So it isn't a matter of existence out of nothing, that creation out of nothing, which, as we say, the Christian world, the scientists say, well, that's what you must believe if you're a Christian or a Jew. And as we've seen, they long ago forgot that, but the Egyptians didn't have that, believe that for a minute. And neither did anyone else there. There was a very good statement here from somebody on that subject, and I can't see it now. It's one of organization. One system, the best known, begins with light, with the spark, which and heaven and earth bring forth the sun and the darkness. It's the light in the darkness. It begins with that. But the darkness still presses. See, the idea you have, the fact the light shouldn't be there, there's something wrong. Because darkness is prevails. That's the law of entropy. That's your second law. Everything runs down, the lights go out, and everything becomes dark, and that's the end of everything. Talk about the heat death. We've read dramatic descriptions of how the sun will die, finally fizzle out and go its final explosion after going through all the necessary phases, every star, everything will cool out, become nothing but a clinker, nothing but a cinder, lifeless and dead forever. The thing that puzzles people today is that should have happened long ago. Why hasn't it happened before? Has it happened long ago? Well, they still argue that. Do we have a fluctuating universe or just a one-way one? But anyway, as far as they're concerned, The darkness was there, and the darkness had to be dealt with in the first place because everything would run down otherwise. So it's a state of inertia. It's a state of entropy that can't move itself. It's this inert matter that Abraham talks about, the earth, there was nothing but earth. And we're told about the children of the helpless one. It's called the helpless one, the Yimachu, who can't help themselves, the Wered, the exhausted. Matter, a person, everything in a time becomes exhausted. And when it's exhausted, where can it go from there? It must be revived from some force outside itself. The Egyptians always insisted on that. They're very fond of using that, the Wered, the exhausted, the tired, the weary one, has nothing left. What can do to stir it to life again? Of course, their concern with resurrection and burial and so forth is very much interested in that. They always put it in, the weary, exhausted one. How are you ever going to bring life to something that hasn't got life in it? It has to come from outside. In this state of inertia, of entropy, it cannot move itself. And they're called the children of the helpless ones. They're represented on earth, of course, by snakes. Entropy is a real force, and it's represented by the great serpent, Apophis, which in the end consumes everything. Ivry reminds you in Norse mythology, of course, of the Fenris wolf, and there is a great serpent too. But in the end, the Fenris wolf will eat everything up, the gods themselves. That's going to win. See, the powers of darkness, it's the Götterdämmerung, see, the turning off of the lights. And the gods themselves don't have a chance because nothing can resist this power of destruction. Of course, the answer to that is always, well, why are we here at all then? There's a mistake. Something went wrong. Something moved against it. But the Egyptians go on and tell us that, the inertia. So what happens? Well, entropy is a real force, and Apophis has to be overcome. So very often, you see in the tombs and so forth, you will find the struggle with Apophis, represented sometimes by a hippo. He is overcome, not forever and ever. He always comes back for more trouble, and he represents Set here. But there's this, after a period of long tension between the two, which would it be, the light or the dark that prevailed? Apophis was overcome, and the time of Re could be entered in. Re is the sun god, the god of light, and so forth. The time of Re, which was the golden age? That was paradise on earth. That was Eden. That was the proper time, the time for which the earth could. Too bad we couldn't have stayed that way. There's another tradition, which some think to be older. Remember, the priests in the temples of Egypt, and there were hundreds of them, these schools had their different schools of interpretation. You're not going to leave them alone with this stuff without arguing about it and inventing just as much as to expect an elder's quorum not to touch the mysteries. They just can't leave them alone. And the Egyptians couldn't, so you have a number of schools and explanations. But they all come back to this basic one. The other one is the earth was covered with water in the beginning and darkness. Of course, this is the Old Testament. Darkness covered the deep and brooded upon the face of the water. And it was dark and inert. It was, as Bonnet says, a form of chaos or disorganization. Of course, that chaos is matter, but matter unorganized. You're not going to have chaos in emptiness, chaos with nothing. You have to have substance. But it's disorganized, and when it's organized, it's not chaos anymore. So the water, but chaos, of course, means the same word, our same word as yawn. It's an empty yawn. It's emptiness. It's nothing in order. We get the idea of chaos as confusion and so forth. But nothing is running there. But then the water was divided, and the appearance of the earth came, the primal mound came. We'll make a division between the waters, and the earth appeared on which man could dwell, and this was the beginning. These were the primal mound, the foundation of this cosmogony. They all work together. We now, it's usually agreed these were all part of the same picture. And remember, Professor Edwards talking about this thing. The pyramid represents nothing else but that primal mound. That's the mound. But it's built over a grave mound, too. So he shows us cases in which you get a pyramid like this. And he notices, though, as I say, he's very conservative and don't want to go in for any crackpot stuff. But this road to heaven, you have to have definite angles here. The thing is definitely naturally boxed to the compass. It is a cosmogonic structure. And the angles, the five, the height is 5 to 8 here, is the pyramid dimension and so forth. But anyway, under the pyramid, including the Great Pyramid, there is a natural mound, and the pyramid's built over that. And the grave is under that mound. That's what the pyramid is for. It just carries it's for going up to heaven. I just noticed yesterday the common word for ma'achat, for grave. The ma'achat That should be an obviously. Ahaz is to raise up. Ma is a thing or a place where something happens. Ma'at means the place where you ascend. Doesn't mean the place where you go down and rest forever. It's not the tomb where you rot and cold, lie in cold obstruction and rot. It is the blessed place of arising. So, and it's interesting that Professor Edwards, who spent 60 years studying pyramids, has finally reached that conclusion that this is what it is. And when you're buried there, when Osiris is buried there, he's only, the whole purpose is to get him out of there, to rise up. And of course the pyramid texts tell you that, all over the place. Well, it became a paradise and the primal mound. Well, at Hermopolis, they elaborated, an egg came out of the mound, and out of the egg came the sun god, or else the lotus, which you find universally, because the lotus, you see, rises. Remember, Egypt was underwater when it was discovered, as the Pearl of Great Price tells us. Remember, when the woman Egyptus discovered it, it was underwater. And the first thing to appear, what appears in the shallow waters, the muddy waters, the swirling waters, and so forth, whether it's in India, China, or anywhere else, the lotus. Miraculous how out of the foulest waters, this gorgeous plant, overnight, it's amazing how it comes. It's a beautiful white flower burst. So, as you may have seen, Professor Edwards showed you a picture. Well, it's over of an object over at the museum here, of the young Tutankhamun's head emerging from a lotus. The king is the sun, and he's rising from the lotus. But the lotus comes out of the darkness and the waters of the beginning that will go together. Waters of the flood, or the waters of noon. Interestingly, this is a thing that Bonnet says, the creation of man doesn't enter into the story. You have no problem about the creation of man, he says, because that's going on every day. If you want to know how people are produced, you ask your old man. And but no, we know how that happens, so he says we don't have to have mysteries, and they don't have mysteries and stories about that at all. Merikara, the great sage, says all persons are images of the Creator who have come out of his own members. Man is in his express image. So that didn't bother them. That wasn't part of the creation. In other words, it's not part of cosmogony. Man is there too, like the other stuff. Now, this, and then he becomes Ta-Chin, as I say. Oh, he here, you notice it's a very strong demonstrative. Ta-Pen-Pel. Ta, now, first about him here. Talk about dualism, soul existence. Ta, a person by the name of Stoke, quite a few years ago, wrote a book on Ta. It was Stoke. And among the other theories that have been very popular is that the name is Ta, is the same as the Ta. You'll recognize what that is, you Hebrew students, your Pata. Patak, Pateach, that's not a very good T, is it? Is Pateach? Well, the Arabic Fataha, that Arabic is better. Yes. Well, a key, the opening line. The opening line of the opening verse of the Quran is called the Fatihun, the opener. Fatah means to open, you see. And the thing that opens is a miftah, is a key. And the Arabic word is miftah, same word. Fatah is to open, and of course it's cognate with English, rather with Latin. And we have patio, meaning to open, to expand. And it's related to pando, to expand, to open up. Pandora, and to open out, patio, to open, say to expand. And it's also been related to father, too, as far as that goes. But Patach, our father, is probably related to the word feeder, food provider, something like that. But anyway, it's been suggested Patach, it means the beginning, the opener, the one who started everything going. That's why this name is given to him, Taha. It's a universal, international name. You're going to find it in lots of things like that. Expand, patio. Patha, furtive, and so forth. He is always represented in human form. None of these gods have anything to do. You will, in all this creation story, you will find no idols. You will find no animal gods or anything like that at all. This is all strictly human. Here he says, Sander Hansen, that noon, the primal material, the ur stuff from which things were made, existed before the creation, was universally believed in the ancient world. Nobody believed in creation out of nothing. That there was a primal substance that existed before the creation, and the creation was the organizing of that substance. And that, he says, was the universal view of the Egyptians, especially the early times, he says. Allgemeine Auffassung. About Ta and so forth, why we call him Ta Chen, we see a lot about him. He's going to be acclaimed. Notice he's being acclaimed on the throne. He's the father. We'll see a lot about him. But the Ta Chen is a rarer form. Oh, you run into that a lot. But Ta Chen means Ta's office translated down to earth. Ta Chen means the exalted one, and refers to the hill. Among other things, the exalted hill. Ta Chen refers both to the first land that emerged after the flood and the first land which emerged in the beginning when waters covered the earth in darkness. There was the later flood emerged, and remember, this is the waters the Egyptian are referring to, as you learn from the Pearl of Great Price. Remember when she discovered the land, it was underwater, she went there after the flood and so forth. But emerging from the flood is a very important thing. And Ta Chen is the land that first emerged, but it is also the person who first occupied it and first lived in it. It means the exalted one, the exalted or uplifted land. It becomes Geb under Nuti. Now, this Ta Chen, this person, is always Thonian. That means he always belongs to the earth. He represents on earth everything that stood for in heaven. He is the earthly representative of the heavenly order. But everything about him is earthy. And so he is Thonian. Thon is the Greek word for black earth. Thonian. See, the solar is the light, and the dark is the Thonian. A typical example, we have a perfect example of that, is in our facsimile number 2, where we have, this part is solar. Notice all these deities are solar deities. They all have suns, and they're moving forth in glory, etc., etc. And all these are Thonian, the cow, the female, and so forth, all these, including the inscription, which tells us that this is the dark place where everything comes to a halt. But you have to have both if you're going to create. You have to, this is the womb, that's why the cow, you see, that's Hathor, the mother cow, the womb from whom all life comes. And the four figures in front of her are, as Joseph Smith says, the four elements, the four regions of the earth from which physical bodies must be compounded. Well, so it tells us here, this is Ta on the throne of Ta Chen. Well, Ta Chen, Wolf has written a good study on Ta Chen in the standard room here. He stirs the earth out of her lethargy, which is called Nen, a state of inertia, a heat death. That is to say, aus ihrem chaosartigen Zustand, out of her condition of chaos. It is Ta Chen who visits the earth and organizes it. He organizes the earth here below. Out of its condition of chaos, he puts things into order. And also, but he does not give it life or force. That he depends on another for that. We're told I have another one on him, yes. He's not the force of the earth at all. He's not a vegetation god. Now, you'd think the earth god would be the vegetation god and all that sort of thing. But he isn't. He joined the lands when the waters were divided. He joined the lands together and made the earth habitable. And he sets the pattern for the king, for Horus Ta Chen. And he is Ta's earthly counterpart. He is almost a byword for Ta. His name is almost a synonym for Ta's name. Ta above, Ta Chen and below, but he carries things up. And he never loses his identity as the exalted one, and his form is purely human. He never takes any form but human. And he wears the same crown. I shouldn't have closed the book here. These two figures, these two sun figures here, where he wears that's being worn by Abraham in facsimile 3, which is the Atif crown. He wears that crown, which is the same that Ammon wears and so forth. And so we get Ta Chenin and Ta. And then the place, the setting, that's the people that begin the play, Act 1, which ends here, is the division between the north and the south, the Shemat and the Wan. It points to it again, Pell. This is the northland, this is the southland. And they are united here at this particular place where the two thrones are joined in one, where the king of the north, the king of the sedge, the suet, and the king of the south rather the king of the north, the Deseret Bee, where Deseret and the bee is the symbol of the North King. His name is Bit, meaning belonging to the bee. Bee is feminine. They knew that the queen bee was a queen already. And the king of the south are united in a single glory. They sing in a Ha'i. Ka'i is a picture of the sun rising over a mount, which represents the king mounting the throne. The two thrones, the line is split, the two thrones are placed side by side, the throne of the king of the north with the sedge, the other with the king of the south, the bee, and the king's shown underneath wearing the white crown, the other king wearing the red crown. Thus everything is divided between the two, and this division is preserved throughout all of Egyptian life. This is a very important thing. In fact, it is the main theme of this document, this, namely, the importance of coexistence here. There, the two thrones are together, and they're as one. Now, you're never going to get rid of evil in the world. The Egyptians would cure that because that was part of the plan. And so, this is why Egypt has been the most stable of all civilizations. They didn't try to wipe out all opposition. They could put up with things. Later, they're less tolerant, however. Notice they wiped out the name of Shevako here. And the theme is eternal life by eternal generation. The Gospel of Philip tells us, nothing is eternal except progeny. Because all worlds pass away, as we're told in the Pearl of Great Price, they come into existence and pass away. What goes on? What doesn't come into existence and pass away? Well, it's the individual and the... I wonder if I can find that statement of Brigham Young's here. There's so much stuff jammed in. It's really a nice one. It's good. You find two. Here's one. No. Well, we'll go on then the next line. So there, here they are, mounting on the single throne. Now, we come to the theme here. Wet itsel yin tem. Much discussion about these lines and what they mean and so forth. Who begot Adam in the beginning? It was Ptah. But Ptah, Adam is the big thing. He is at Heliopolis, he is everything. Which is, always put here as Adam. It's very interesting in the very old coffin texts. Some of the coffin texts, he's called Adamu, using the Canaanite ending, U, and also the soft D instead of T. He's Adam. Adam and Adam. In fact, Lefebvre, Egyptologist, went to quite a great length to show that this is the same as Adam, as a matter of fact. And of course, he obviously is Adam here. And so it says here, Adam, who was begotten, and who then became the father of, then begot the father of the Pesach, or the Great Council. The Pesach is always translated Ennead, but is it the Ennead? I notice how Zeta, who edited the text, sums it up here. Let me see if I can find it. It's agreed today that Ennead doesn't have to be 9, it doesn't have to be 8, it doesn't have to be any particular number. It means the vast number. The numberless council of the gods is what it means. You see how he put Ennead here. Well, who cares? It's important, though. He's not... They will always use that. You see, there's the 9 gods, and then but there are dozens of listings of them. They're not the same two, and sometimes they'll add one, and they'll take some off, and they'll add 5 or 6, and half of them are female. Should be originally half should be female, half male, with Ta making the odd number. You see, and it breaks down into covenants, such as Shu and Tefnut, and Geb, and Neith, and so forth. But he says, no. What this means is, gotta find this kind of thing. Children of the helpless one. But first, for our Adam, his name is a very important one. There's lots been written by it, especially by Rudolf Anthus. He's written several long articles and monographs about the name of Adam, which it means many, as we're told in Moses 1 and 34. He called their name Adam, which is many. And of course, it means many here. I notice that even Siegfried Morens, a very prejudiced character, he says what it means is a Gesamtheit. It's an accumulation, not it's a gathering. A Gesamtheit means it's a compound, a complex. It includes everything in itself, and you'll see why.
Because the word is very, very productive in Egypt. It's a word that means almost anything. All it is, you just draw a sled, you see. And this is the sled. And this is Tem. And it means, it's a regular verb meaning to be. It also means not to be. It's the regular negative verb, not to be. Both to be and not to be.
It means to complete a circle. And immediately you think of the Hebrew word for perfect. Job was an upright man. Yashar was Tamim, upright and perfect, Tamim. Tamim means a perfect circle. It comes right back to the beginning where it started. Of course, Tamim is the standard Arabic word for perfect or complete. Perfect means perfect and complete. Well, Adam is the one who is perfect and complete. And, there are all sorts of things we go in when we get to the Adam literature. We may get to that and talk about it. But in Egyptian, it means, to be complete, to be everything, to be nothing, and not to be. And Tem, the basic meaning they give as Mestem, one who begot all. Mestem. Well, that's what it's written as here. See, this is Mestem, as the father of all. Mes means, as the word, as you know, the word like Moses and so forth. It means to beget, to have a child, and Mestem is the one who begot all. And Ansa says the name of Adam is there, who represents the gathering of all that's gone before in himself and all that's come after in himself. He is the great bottleneck, I mean, completion. As to his own origin, we're told, is deliberately left unrevealed or unreported. There are various theories, of course. He came out of the Nun, he was begotten for another, but in the pyramid text, the oldest writings we have after this, he is the primal god who comes down to earth first, the first one to set foot on the primal hill when the water is divided, when the land becomes habitable, Adam is the first one to occupy it. We're told in one text he needed no magic because he came first. He was a real fact. He doesn't need to create himself, create something. But he has a companion, the Amon's Palakita, his mate. Palakita is a very interesting way of putting it. As Bonnet does, which means his companions, his helpmeet, his palakid, who was Hathor of Heta. Hathor, the woman who settled the land, Seosis. And the priestesses of the Adam temple were always called Hathors. And that goes back, he thinks, to a tree cult, because they had this tree of life business here. in spite of any magic background, the creation was an act of mind. But at Heliopolis, there was a real marriage, we're told. We get the psyche.
Is that the same as the Hathor cow?
The which?
The cow Hathor with Atum, his companion?
Yes, yes. She was reckoned Hathor as a cow, yeah. Of course, she wasn't a cow. In the cosmogony of Heliopolis, now incidentally, right where the rivers meet, this is Heliopolis, or honestly, where the airport is today. It's right here. It's the On of the Bible, and Unel, they would write it Unel, meaning the pillars, stone pillars. It's the old megalithic foundation. Very important in the New Testament. That's where Moses lived, where Joseph married the daughter of the high priest, where Abraham taught and was taught and so forth. Everybody went to Heliopolis, and the earliest Christian accounts say that that's where Jesus' parents took him when they went. There were two temples, the temple at Jerusalem and the temple at Heliopolis, were sort of polar. They were in constant contact, not constant contact, but in the Bible they're in frequent contact with each other. We get to more of that. He brought forth the first pair, which bringing together became the source of all life on earth. They're the first flesh. But it's an interesting thing. Adam schafft nicht erzeugt. He does not create, he begets. He is a father. He does not create, others do that. And then this said, of course, a lot of this idea, who begot himself. What's it talking about there? Diodorus tells us, the seed, not the womb, it contains the life, the child. Therefore, Adam contained in himself the life as in a womb, and so he is both father and mother. Bonnet insists that there's nothing offensive about this. No lust is involved. It was really a compromise with matriarchy. Whatever the form the child may have in the seed, without the mother, it cannot enter into this stage of existence. And that's what we're after. This may seem like a mystery, but remember in the Book of Mormon when Christ says, I am the Father and the Son. Well, I think President Joseph Fielding Smith explains that very well when he said, who made it possible for us to be resurrected and live in bodies hereafter? Jesus Christ. Without him, it wouldn't have been possible. He is literally, he is the Father of our everlasting, eternal bodies. Not the bodies we have here. This is something else. But when we're resurrected, he has made that possible. So he is the Father and the Son. And of course, anybody can be a Father and a Son at the same time. I've achieved that difficulty. What's his name? Father Verdenissen Schreier. Father Sein, Doug Egenstein. Morgenstern, isn't it? It's Morgenstern. Now, the conflict between the patriarchy and matriarchy, about which a lot has been written, this is dissolved in a very simple question, namely with this. Which one is it, the father or mother, who makes birth possible? You leave one of them out and birth is impossible. Which one is it that makes birth possible? Is it the father or the mother? Well, of course, it's silly. Silly question. We're told, when Adam's son's shoe separated the earth and heaven, male and female, it was really Adam himself who was doing it all. So we have Adam, he comes down here and he is the father of the human race in every sense. He comes down, he transfers it, but you say, well, this is getting sort of complicated. What have we got here? It goes on, you see. So, Ta begot Adam, who was the father of these of the council of the gods. And now the play begins. Iab NF Hesitate. He called together. Iab means to call a family together, to call a gathering together. It's quite often in those verses in the Coffin text, 131 following, 146. The marvelous passage is about sealing one's family to oneself in the other world so that you can be united in the hereafter, exactly as we understand it, exactly as we understand it. As the Egyptologist A.T. Allen at Chicago pointed out long ago. But he said he covered together all the family. He called together the family of the gods. Adam did. And Wep F. Her N. To settle an affair between Horus and Seth. Now there are these two plans. He had his plan, and Horus favored the god's plan, and Seth had a perfect right to object if he wanted to. But they were going to discuss it. And Seth, you can never get rid of Seth. He's always there. He was cast out of heaven not because he disagreed, but because he resorted to violence in heaven. You notice there is not, as we're told in the book of Moses 7:31, there is not before thy throne but peace, justice, and wisdom. Well, so to settle this affair between Horus and Seth, then he began, Helenef Shentelsen, he began by forbidding all contention. There shall be no contention among you. What was the first thing the Lord said to the Nephites when he came to them? There shall be no contention among you as there has been in the past. Contention is all contention, is not of me, but of the devil. But it's contention that stirs up the hearts of the children of men to bloodshed. Now you shall not contend. So he shall in, means he accepted, he wiped out, he absolutely forbade, very interesting words used shall we hear. And F. Shentel, that there should be any wrangling, any controversy between Horus and Seth. He did it by establishing Seth in the kingdom of the south. And he did it then by establishing in the place where his father, well, in the place, it doesn't say that, in the place where he was initiated. Best, that's a funny word that uses there, best, in the place where he received his initiation. Later on it says in the place where he was born. It's funny, nobody accepts this initiation, but that's what's written. It says in the place where he was, best means to be introduced into the mysteries, into the ordinances, in the place where that happened, in a place called Sau. Is it Geb who does it here? No, not yet. So, yes, it was Geb. It's now Geb who takes over. He's not mentioned before this. And then Geb established. Well, we got to have Geb. Have you mentioned Geb before? Well, Geb is very important. He is the earth god. He's the earth god, but never a vegetation god. We mentioned him. He's very much like Tachenon, you see. But Geb is much more intimate. He is in the family. He is the principle of patriarchal succession on earth. He represents Geb. That's why he says here, he was never a vegetation god. He doesn't represent the powers of the earth, which must be stimulated from above Things grow out of him, but never because of him. Geb and Nut, they are the two who begat Re. Remember, Geb is the earth god, and Nut is the heaven stretched above him, is the female stretched above. And we see pictures of that out in the museum right now. Geb and Nut, the two of them. Nut is the heaven. Well, anyway, Geb, they begat Re, making him the father of the gods. Now, he represents, now various authorities here, the patriarchal, monarchical power on earth. He's a reflection of the heavenly order here below. He is the Repat, meaning the mouth of the race, Erpat, Repat on the throne of Geb. Any king, if he wanted to send somebody out on a mission to represent him, could let him sit on his own throne by courtesy, and then he was a Repat, authorized to speak for the king. And of course, that's exactly what we had in facsimile 3. Abraham, by politeness of Pharaoh, being allowed to sit on his throne. People used to laugh at that and say, that's absurd. Pharaoh wouldn't allow anybody else to sit on his throne. Well, don't fool yourself. Any Repat could sit on his throne. And recently there's been a long, long study on that called Repat on the Throne of Geb. He established his son Osiris as well as Horus, who both sit on the throne of Geb. He makes the lord of earthly dynasties as heirs of Geb, attested by the Mekis which they hold, etc. And he is always, like all cosmic gods, he is always represented in human form. The goose associated with him is a phonetic way of writing his name. It's purely phonetic. But he is always a human being, so all these people so far have been people engaged in this particular drama. And he wears the Atef crown. He wears the same crown that the kings wear there. And he is the Wetu. The Wetu means the next in the patriarchal line, the most immediate to the throne, the true successor. The archaic title being Wetwawet. Well, then, I see he's taking too much time.